95% of the new generating capacity around the world last year came from sun and wind and batteries. The numbers are truly astonishing. The Earth is generating a third more power from the sun this summer than it did last summer. China was putting up 3 gigawatts of solar panels a day. A gigawatt's the rough equivalent of a large coal-fired power plant. California, fourth largest economy in the world, from winter into early summer was using 40% less natural gas to make electricity than they had 2 years prior.
That's Bill McKibben, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Bill McKibben on the clean energy revolution. 2024 was the hottest year ever recorded. 2025 will probably be even worse. Our planet is heating up. If present trends continue, a UN panel of scientists says it would be disastrous for humankind. Fossil fuels, including coal, are major contributors to global warming. So what is the regime in Washington doing about it? It's promoting fossil fuels with its mantra-like chants, clean, beautiful coal, and drill, baby, drill. However, energy from the sun and wind is cheaper, more reliable, and better for the climate. And it's growing faster than any energy source in history. Bill McKibben says, quote, "Our liberations and our destruction are arriving at precisely the same time. Everything is going wrong except this one big thing. Our species, at what feels like a dark moment, can take a giant leap into the light of the sun." Our guest today is Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org. He's a leading environmental activist. He's the recipient of the Gandhi Peace Prize and the Right Livelihood Award. He's the founder of Third Act, which organizes people over the age of 60 for action on climate justice. He's the author of many books. His latest is Here Comes the Sun. He spoke in Boulder, Colorado in late September. And now, Bill McKibben, the clean energy revolution.
Always a particular pleasure to be in Boulder. I remember many trips here over the years, but I remember particularly, I think, coming in 2011 when Occupy was at its height, and I was helping out by sort of visiting Occupy encampments around the country and talking to people and whatever, and it was all fun and, you know, but very, you know, New York, down Zuccotti Park, downtown, very gritty and, you know, and place after place, and Boulder was the 15th or 20th of these that I'd gotten to, and I got there and I gave my talk. And at the end, they gave me a gift bag with all kinds of nice lip balm and stuff. I thought, no, I'm in Boulder now, you know. This is where we are. On the other hand, you have me in an unexpectedly, for me, chipper frame of mind. My job for many years has essentially been to bum people out. To be a kind of roving Cassandra of one kind or another. And you would think that this would be the perfect moment for some more of that, because the world is in a darker place than I ever remember it. You know, all the things that I wrote about in The End of Nature almost 40 years ago, which was the first book about what we then called the greenhouse effect, all that stuff's more or less happening. In fact, it's playing out even more dramatically and quickly than we would have guessed. We now see, you know, real and deep damage to the most fundamental systems on the planet. The jet stream and the Gulf Stream are faltering and flickering. And faltering and flickering to our democracy in ways that would have been inconceivable to me at any other point in my life, even in the first Trump administration. There's a a craziness to it all that, you know, knocks me awake many a morning at 3 o'clock, just pondering what to do and how to deal with it. And probably never more so than today, when the President of the United States gave the single most bonkers speech in the history of the United Nations. Not the longest speech, that was Fidel Castro in 1960, not the most provocative, I guess, that was Nikita Khrushchev banging his shoe on the podium at the UN, but definitely the craziest speech. And in some ways, profoundly, profoundly embarrassing for Americans to have this in a way that I've never quite felt before. So, a very, very dark moment, and yet there is one big good thing happening all of a sudden on planet Earth, and it's big enough and good enough that I think it stands some chance of taking a bite out of both the climate crisis and the authoritarianism crisis. And that one big good thing is this very sudden, over the last 36 months or so, very rapid, dramatic, surging rise in clean energy around the Earth. Now, of course, in places like Boulder, there's, you know, there's always been people with solar panels, and we've always known about alternative energy, and, you know, on and on and on. I've had them on my house for a quarter century and so on. But it was always kind of off in its own, kind of off at the children's table of energy, you know. And all of a sudden, it's not alternative in the least. 95% of the new generating capacity around the world last year came from sun and wind and batteries. The numbers are truly astonishing. The Earth is generating a third more power from the sun this summer than it did last summer. China in May, which is the last month for which we have good numbers, in May, China was putting up 3 gigawatts of solar panels a day. A gigawatt's the rough equivalent of a large coal-fired power plant, bigger than the one that used to be here in Boulder, I think. So they were putting up the solar equivalent of that every 8 hours across China. California, which took this stuff seriously, California passed some kind of tipping point about 14 months ago. Now, almost every day, they generate more than 100% of the power they use for long periods of the day from the sun and the wind and hydro. At night, when the sun goes down, the biggest source of supply on the California grid are batteries, which weren't there 3 years ago, but that have been soaking up excess sunshine all afternoon. California, fourth largest economy in the world, from winter into early summer was using 40% less natural gas to make electricity than they had 2 years prior. So that's the kind of number, big enough to start, if it's applied around the world, not stopping global warming. It is way too late for that. As you know, this audience knows better than any other, there's no audience in the world more educated about the science of climate than people in this town. Too late to stop global warming, but not too late, perhaps, to start knocking tenths of a degree off how hot the planet's eventually going to get. And every tenth of a degree Celsius that we raise the temperature at this point moves 100 million of our brothers and sisters from a safe climate zone into a dangerous one. So this is the most important task that humans have ever undertaken. And finally, finally, for the first time, we have a scalable tool that will help us undertake it. Finally, for the first time, there's at least some hope that we can start driving down the amount of carbon that we're pouring into the atmosphere. So, in that sense, a very beautiful moment. It was about 5 years ago that we crossed some invisible line where it became cheaper to produce energy from pointing a sheet of glass at the sun than from burning coal and oil and gas. That was an epochal moment for our species. Humans have been happily setting things on fire for at least 700,000 years. Mostly a good idea. You know, we learned to cook food. That gave us the big brain. Questionable whether that was a helpful advance or not. But, you know, we were able to move north and south from the equator. Many fewer people living along the Front Range before they invented fire. The anthropologists even think that standing around the campfire for eons upon eons helped build the social bonds that mark our species, a kind of proto-Zoom, you know. And then when we learned to control the combustion of coal and gas and oil, that was modernity. I mean, that's the Industrial Revolution that created everything that we know around us. But the cost is now too high to continue. The cost, obviously, in terms of the climate system, which is on the edge of collapse and which we have only the shortest amount of time. It's not just the climate system, though. You know, 9 million human beings die every year, one death in five on this planet, from breathing the combustion byproducts of fossil fuel, those particulates that lodge in the lungs. There's 5 million school children in New Delhi. 2.5 million of them have irreversible lung damage from breathing the air. Not necessary anymore. And there's the eternal problem of the fact that when you rely on a scarce resource that's only available in a few places, the people who control those places end up with way more power than they should have. I mean, the first guy to figure this out was our first real plutocrat, John D. Rockefeller. And, you know, now are the biggest oil and gas barons in America for the last three decades have been the Koch brothers. They control the most refining and pipeline capacity. They use their winnings to systematically erode our democracy. If you wonder why it was so easy for Donald Trump to kick it over, it was because they'd sawed off a lot of the supports over the last few decades. In Europe, the biggest oil and gas baron is Vladimir Putin, you know, last week using his winnings to send drones to probe the defenses of Poland. A sentence that should send a chill down the spine of anyone who remembers the 20th century. It's beautiful to imagine a world where everybody can produce the energy that they need in the place where they are. It's beautiful. It's painful and beautiful to contemplate how different the history of the last 100 years would have been if oil had been of trivial value in that period. The number of wars and coups and assassinations and terrorist plots and things that would have been avoided. So this is a fundamentally gorgeous moment for human beings, a chance for a real reorientation of the world around us. It's not a free lunch. There are no free lunches, but there are definitely more expensive and less expensive lunches, and this falls directly into the latter category. Yeah, you have to go mine some stuff in order to build batteries and solar panels and things, but the difference is so obvious when you think about it that it really should sort of help set your mind at ease. You go mine some lithium and you put it in a battery and there it works for a very long time, decades probably. And when the battery degrades, we now are able to recycle the lithium and it's valuable enough that we do and take it out and start making the next battery. When you go mine some coal, you set it on fire and have to mine some more the next day. That's why your neighbors up at the Rocky Mountain Institute did a study last September saying that all the mining that we'd need to do between now and 2050 for this renewable battery energy transition was less than the volume of coal we mined on this planet last year. A way to keep it in your mind is, a boatload full of solar panels over its lifetime will produce 500 times the energy that a boatload full of coal or oil or gas will produce. It's a completely different thing that we're talking about now. It's basically the application of human ingenuity that is the resource that we're using to capture the sunlight that streams onto the world every day. We started down this path in 1954 in Edison, New Jersey at Bell Labs. There might be one or two people in this room old enough to have helped fund this work by dropping dimes in payphones in their youth, you know. We almost got there in the 1970s when Jimmy Carter, engineer, wanted to deal with the oil crisis by turning to the sun. And he came to Golden, Colorado to give the speech that should have launched the solar era. It was pouring rain that day. Typical, I'm afraid, of Mr. Carter's luck. But not only did he put solar panels on the White House roof, he put money in his final budget sufficient to do the research that they reckoned would allow America to provide 20% of its power from the sun by the year 2000. And had we done that, we would live on a very different planet, a much cooler one. We didn't do that. Ronald Reagan was elected instead, took down those solar panels, committed us to the path of drilling for oil as the way out of all things. The next great moment came not in the U.S., but in Germany at the turn of the century. The Green Party, which in European parliamentary systems, unlike ours, the Green Party is a very useful thing. The Green Party used its leverage as the balance of power to get what we called the Energiewende, the energy transition underway, and the German government agreed to pay large sum to people who put solar panels on their roof. They'd buy the electricity back at a high price. And that expensive work of the German government created the demand that allowed the Chinese to start to get good at making solar panels cheaply, and people just got better and better and better at it. And now we're at this place where it's really possible to see a different future. I think maybe the most beautiful story comes from Pakistan. Pakistan been harder hit by climate change than any country on earth. It gets to be 125, 126 routinely now in its big cities in the summer, right at the edge of human survival. They've had the two greatest floods since Noah in 2010 and 2022. But they have one deep geographical advantage in this case, which is a long border with China. And that meant that as the Chinese overproduced solar, cheap solar panels, they were flooding across the border. People who 3 years ago were, you know, importing rice or cement or something turned their entrepreneurial talents to solar panels, and they found a ready audience because the electric grid in Pakistan is expensive and unreliable. And so without government help, just people basically going on YouTube and TikTok and watching videos with Hindustani music in the background, Pakistanis last year managed to build in 8 months the equivalent of something like half the country's national electric grid. They imported 17 gigawatts worth of solar panels last year. That's a huge amount of energy. Pakistani farmers were early adopters. Those of you who've traveled in rural Asia know that the soundtrack for that part of the world is the cough and hum of the diesel generators that are running the pumps to pull the water up from the deep tube wells that are the residue of the Green Revolution of the 1960s. That diesel's often the biggest input on a farmer's budget, so they were happy to have these solar panels. They usually lacked the money to build the metal supports we're familiar with, so they just laid them on the ground, pointed them at the sun. Pakistani farmers last year used 35% less diesel than they did the year before. Now that same thing's starting to happen across Africa. In the last 6 months, we've seen huge increase, really on any place where there's a strong Chinese trade route, where people are, there's 600 million people in Africa without electricity at all. Fossil fuel failed to provide it despite 250 years of opportunity. So now people are getting their first modern energy by putting up village-scale microgrids in place after place after place, and it's incredibly beautiful to watch. And beautiful to watch all the things that quickly come afterwards. In somewhat more affluent parts of the developed world, that's often the EV. We think of Detroit as the center of automotive technology on this planet. No more. The most important car cities are two or three places in China whose names are hard for me to pronounce, but they're producing the best and cheapest cars on the planet. They're also producing, in many other places now, huge quantities of e-bikes, which may turn out to be the even more spectacular invention that comes from this. A bicycle is a pretty good invention to begin with, and I know that Boulderites are deeply serious about their spandex and their, you know. But to have invented a bicycle without hills is a pretty remarkable, you know, thing, and that's what we now have. The heat pump replacing the furnace in people's basement and the air conditioner in their window, the induction cooktop. I'm the cook in my family, so I've for many years had, cost me $60 on Amazon, induction cooktop boils water twice as fast as the, you know, gas stove that I used most of my life. And I wish I'd known this when my child was young, if you have a gas stove in the kitchen, your kid has a 50% better chance of getting asthma, which if you think about it is not a great shock because what you have is a campfire in your kitchen, which is not a good thing. All these things are elegant and beautiful. I've been hearing from friends, I haven't been to China for 18 months, but I've been hearing from people regularly now that you can easily tell the difference in Beijing and Shanghai, that it's not only cleaner, it's way, way quieter in the middle of the city than it used to be. Because way more than half the cars sold in China now come with a plug out the back. All of it's beautiful and at very deep levels, except if you own a coal mine or an oil well, at which point it's the ugliest development possible because it threatens to take the reserves that you have carefully hoarded away and render them valueless in a pretty short period of time, which explains a lot about what's happened in American politics in the last 18 months. If I know that California was using 40% less natural gas, you can be assured that Chevron and Exxon and everybody else down in the Permian Basin knew it too. When Donald Trump, as candidate, told oil executives that for the low, low price of $1 billion in campaign donations, they could have anything that they wanted, and he said it, as is his wont, quite openly, they went to work and they raised about $500 million between donations and advertising and lobbying expenses in the last election cycle, and that was clearly enough because we now have in this country a administration unique in the world doing everything it can to slow down this transition and prevent it from happening. The scale of that effort is almost beyond comprehension. They closed down work on a 80% completed wind farm off the coast of Rhode Island 3 weeks ago. Federal court told them yesterday that they couldn't, but of course they're going to appeal it to the Supreme Court, where all bad ideas go to be ratified at this point in our history. It's truly crazy what we're doing. When American historians look back at the last 6 months, they'll describe it as a period of the kind of rise of fascism in America. When world historians look at it, the thing that they will say, I think, is that this was the period when the West ceded technological, economic, and probably with it political primacy to China in the course of a very few months. It's a period like no other. But we desperately need to make sure that the U.S. doesn't become such a caboose on this train that it holds the whole world back. That's what they're trying to do. To understand why we're putting tariffs on everything, an easy primer is the fact that we're using them as leverage to make people buy large quantities of liquefied natural gas from the Gulf of Mexico. Gulf of Mexico. We made the Europeans pledge to buy $750 billion and the Japanese $500 billion and on and on and on. This may work in the short run. It may not, too. I don't think they'll actually follow through on all those purchases. But in the even slightly longer run, there's not a country on earth that wants to have its energy supply dependent on a supplier as fickle and erratic as the United States, not when they could just go buy a bunch of Chinese solar panels and rely instead on the sun, which has faithfully come up every morning so far, you know? Three weeks ago, Indonesia, fourth largest country in the world, announced plans to build 100 gigawatts of solar power over the next 5 years. That was an important tell, I think, about where things are going. In order to push things in America, we need, as usual, to organize and try and make it happen. We can't wait for the sheer economics of this to win out, because that'll take a little longer than the planet has. 30 years from now, we will run the world on sun and wind because of economics, but if it takes us 30 years, or really anything like it, to get there, then the planet we run on sun and wind will be a broken planet. So that's why we organize. We had this beautiful day two days ago. So many thanks for the people in this room who helped hard with Sun Day. There were 500 events around the world. The logo for Sun Day is half a sun. A really wonderful design team came up with it because it represents the fact that we're halfway there. And we have the technology, we need the political will to put it into effect. About 10,000 people so far have gone to the website at sunday.earth and drawn in their own version of that sun to go with it, and I hope you will too. There's Jane Fonda's that she sent in from the Amazon when I asked. And they're just beautiful, and they're just, you know, the images from the other day were profound and wonderful. They're just beginning to flow in. I think that's Portland, Oregon. That's there I was in lower Manhattan, where we had really profound day of talk and action. But just beautiful pictures from around the country. So grateful to everybody, because simply in this case, spreading the message is exceptionally helpful. This is a fight that we can win because people are inclined in this way already. The support for clean energy, which is enormous when we poll about it, crosses all partisan and ideological lines pretty easily.
You're listening to Bill McKibben on the Clean Energy Revolution. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
Texas is the now fastest moving clean energy state in the country. And Big Oil tried to beat this back at the Texas legislature last session. They had a whole bunch of bills that people thought would pass. The most prominent was one that the newspapers were calling DEI for natural gas, because if you were going to put up 5 megawatts of solar, you'd have to put up 5 megawatts of natural gas too. And out of the woodwork came Texans, mostly rural Texans, saying, don't do this. This is how we pay for the schools in our county. You know, this is what keeps the old folks home open where we are. Do not do that. And they didn't. The Texas legislature just returned to its prime mission of redistricting in order to, you know, help the president. I'll tell you a story about the most beautiful thing, in a way, not the most important, but the most beautiful that's happened in Europe in the last 3 years, which is the spread of this thing we're calling balcony solar. for apartment dwellers. And this couldn't be easier. I mean, you just go down to whatever the Best Buy in Brussels is, and you come back with your solar panel for a few hundred euros, and it's designed to not go on the roof, you just hang it over the railing of your balcony. And then it just has a normal plug on the back that you stick in the wall. You don't need an electrician. You don't need to rewire anything. Often it provides 20% of the power that a small apartment uses. So it's not going to save the world, but it's an excellent gateway drug, and it can provide a fair amount of power. It's illegal everywhere in America, except that progressive bastion, the Deseret State of Utah, where by a unanimous vote of both houses of the state legislature, they passed enabling legislation earlier this year, because some Republican state senator, who I've talked to and a good guy, just stood up and said, well, damn it, if it's good enough for the people of Stuttgart, it's good enough for the people of Provo. They shouldn't be denied the right to do this thing. And so now there's lots and lots of video on YouTube of earnest and smiling Utahns, you know, plugging in their balcony solar and gazing fondly at their app, showing the electrons hitting their... If that can be done in the state of Utah, surely it can be done in the city of Boulder or the state of Colorado in relatively short order. So you all have your marching orders. We just need to organize. I'm just surveying some of the demographics in this room. So I'm going to talk for a moment about old people like me, okay? Those of us who have reached at least the age of 60, who we've organized in this group called Third Act, and I think there's some third actors here from the neighborhood, but we badly need the rest of you joining in, because we've turned in 3 years into a very effective fighting force of about 100,000 Americans who are taking this stuff dead seriously. They were the kind of organizing backbone of Sunday, though many other groups joined in, and we've done lots of other work, as we must, because otherwise our legacy is going to be a planet far worse than the one that we found. And because there are truly a lot of young people feeling really severe, what we call climate anxiety or climate despair. But in my experience, it's less because of the actual state of the planet and more because of the sense that they've been abandoned to deal with it on their own, okay? Which has been, in some ways, too true. It is time for those of us who've scooped the cream off the top to figure out how to make sure that we do what we can. And we can do a lot to make this happen. You know, it costs, we can't do anything in Washington right now. 18 months from now, maybe, and we're going to fight the midterms hard at Third Act. But right now, we can do tons at state houses and city halls. Costs three times as much to put solar on your roof in America as it does in Australia or the EU. Large part of that's down to the crazy level of bureaucracy. We have 15,000 municipalities in this country. Each has their own building code, their own team of building inspectors who would like to go climb on your roof. This is not really necessary. In the rest of the world, you can get a solar panel installed in a matter of days, not a matter of months, and at much, much lower prices. Happily, there's an app for that developed, of course, by your neighbors at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, Solar App Plus. It allows for instant permitting for most rooftops. It's now mandated in California and Maryland, and as of last week, New Jersey. Colorado decided for some reason not to do it last year, but that's a mistake, one that needs to be righted. We need to be a little bolder than we have been in this regard, because we are in an emergency. And so we should not worry quite so much about whether or not a solar panel might mar the historic roofline of a house. The thing that's going to mar the historic homes of Boulder is when they catch on fire and burn down, okay? So time to move with a little more dispatch. I've just sort of taken it as one of my tasks to sort of try and persuade my tribe of somewhat overeducated old white people to stop suing to block things they don't want to look at, okay? We need to push a little more aggressively. That's the end of my little sermonette. And I'll just end by returning to the part of all this that just deeply, deeply moves me. You know, I obviously stole the title of this book from George Harrison. And it turns out that when you go to Spotify, Here Comes the Sun is by far the most streamed song in the Beatles' vast catalog. Twice as many people a day listen to it around the world as Let It Be or Hey Jude or anything. And I think because in dark times, that gentle and optimistic song is very soothing. And I also think it's because human beings have a deep and powerful connection to the sun. We were putting together a playlist of songs for Sunday, and there were hundreds to choose from. Everybody who ever wrote a good song wrote one about, you know, Stevie Wonder did, and Bill Withers did, and, you know, just, you could just go on for hours. We had a list hundreds long. Somewhat longer than the list of great songs about fracking, you know. The sun is the most charismatic object in our corner of the universe, you know. We can't look at it directly, but if we don't get enough of it, we literally get sad, seasonal affective disorder, or whatever they call it. There's no human being I ever met who didn't grin involuntarily when the sun came out from behind the clouds and hit them in the shoulder blades, you know? And so the prospect that this star that already provides us with light and warmth and via photosynthesis with our supper is now willing to provide us with all the power we could ever ask for is just such a... I have a new grandson for the first time, so I'm, you know, deeply loved, someone who theoretically will hopefully be around in the 22nd century. So it is incumbent upon us to envision some way to make the 22nd century a possibility, you know. And this strikes me as one of the absolute key parts of allowing that to happen. I make no promises that we'll win this fight, because we don't know. We've waited very late to get started. But last spring before last, in Vermont, we had the path of the total solar eclipse came through Vermont. And so people from all over the eastern seaboard flooded into Vermont to watch. It was the biggest traffic jams in Vermont history, even bigger than the last Fish concert in Vermont. But they were very happy traffic jams because everyone had had such a good time. I was on the quad at Middlebury College with 1,500 students, and they all put down their phones for a good half hour and watched this incredible spectacle play out. And it was just a reminder to me that we really don't want to be as alienated from the natural world as we've allowed ourselves to become. We don't know exactly how people back in prehistoric times thought about things, but we have some sense that the sun was pretty important to them, because every time we find a pile of stones like Stonehenge, it somehow points towards the solstice or the equinox, you know. That's who we could be. My mantra has become, you know, energy from heaven, not from hell. And I think that that's a world that it's at least worth trying to build. So thank you all very much for being a part of it. Thank you all. Now, I've rattled on longer than I should have, and we're going to go sign some books because, you know, supporting the bookstore really is a crucial. Those communities that took for granted their bookstores no longer have their bookstore, so it's good that you all have. But we have time for a few questions, and people have provided a few in advance, this list of questions. Some of which I think I've answered in going through, but I'll just take a look at a couple of these things here and see if there's some that I might want to add, and then we'll open it up, and if other people have things that they're curious about. One of the questions is, do we have land enough to make this happen? And the answer is, in this case, very much yes. It is going to take some land. We think Mark Jacobson at Stanford is the kind of leading authority here, says 1.5% of the surface of pretty much every country on Earth is sufficient in order to do this. And even most of that 1.5% is the land in between wind turbines in big farms. It's probably less than we're currently using for oil and gas. You guys have a sense of how much landscape is kind of off limits because there are gas wells and stuff dotted through it. But we are going to have to use some. And I think that's okay. We use a fair amount of land for energy right now. America's biggest crop is corn. We grow 60 million acres of it. 30 million acres of that corn is turned into ethanol. And that ethanol from that 30 million acres provides 3% of America's energy. If you took that same 30 million acres and covered it with solar panels, which we don't want to do because just carpeting Indiana and Iowa with solar panels seems unfair, but if we did, that 30 million acres would provide not 3% of our energy, but about 100% of the energy that we currently use. I got a real sense of this in an Illinois cornfield last summer when I was working on the book. And there was a farmer who was converting his land, and some of it, and he said, here's an acre that I have in ethanol, and that corn produces enough ethanol every year to drive my Ford F-150 25,000 miles. This acre I've turned to solar panels. It produces enough electrons every year to drive my Ford F-150 Lightning EV version of the same truck, not 25,000 miles, but 700,000 miles. That sort of hit home when he said that. Photosynthesis is a miracle, but not a very efficient one necessarily, at least in comparison. He also said, you know something else? To make those solar panels work, I do not need to pour large quantities of nitrogen and phosphorus on them that will then wash downstream into the Gulf of Mexico and create a large dead zone. I don't need to strafe them with herbicides and pesticides. In fact, having put up all those solar panels, I find myself left with half a field, the aisles in between the solar panels, which all of a sudden are the kind of tabula rasa for an entirely new field of human endeavor that we're calling by the very clunky name of agrivoltaics, which we definitely need a better name for. If you think about it, what a solar farm is doing is producing two things, electrons and shade. And on an overheating planet, shade is actually a highly valuable commodity. We're figuring out that there are lots of crops that you can grow more of when you're in that. I was just looking at the numbers from these French vintners who were saying that their Chardonnay grapes were yielding 60% more when they had grown amidst solar panels. Now, I'm a beer guy, so that does nothing for me. but there you go. In Vermont, what we're doing is putting, between a lot of them, just planting pollinator-friendly flowers and weeds, and the number of pollinating insects increases by about 100 times compared with the farm field that was there before. And that means that the orchards around there report 30-40% increases in fruit set, you know, because all of a sudden there's enough insects on hand to get their stuff done. When we get away from monocultures of all kinds, agricultural, energy, whatever, there's room for kind of interesting human creativity. I'm doing a bad job with these questions because I just keep... someone says, with the rapid uptake of artificial intelligence across all industries, do you see hope that these are just going to overwhelm the electric demand with these data centers? First of all, I think it's still a little unclear exactly how much energy all this is going to draw, because it's pretty unclear how much of a business case there really is for using AI, which so far is a fairly, its main use case so far is, helping your junior high school students cheat on their homework. It'll find some uses, but it's not at all clear that it's going to be the thing that its boosters hope. Microsoft is not building all the data centers they said they were going to build last year. Amory Lovins up at Snowmass has just put out a really interesting paper that I recommend, saying that it's really not going to be that big a part of our energy future. But if you're determined to build them, the only way to build them fast, which is what they all say they must be built in order to stay ahead of the Chinese, the only way to build them fast is with solar farms and wind turbines, because this is the only kind of energy that we know how to put up fast. If you want to put up a gas power plant now, turbines are in back order through 2030. If you want to put up a nuclear power plant, well, no one's going to do that before 2035 at best. And when they do, it'll probably be way more expensive than the relying on the very large nuclear reactor 93 million miles up in the sky. We can build solar farms in a matter of weeks, really days, as the Chinese are now demonstrating. So if we're going to do this, that's probably how we're going to do it. And I think with that, I managed to answer several of the questions at once that are on here. So I'm going to just, do we have enough time that we can shout out a couple more questions here? Is that okay? Only one. Is that what you're saying? We do have time for a couple. Okay. There, we'll start there, and we'll go to this side after that. Thank you. It's really important to just sort of think about all of you who, so many people in this room have worked so hard in the climate movement over the last decades. And for much of that time, most of that time, we were in a world where fossil fuel was cheap and renewable energy was expensive. And so the job in large part was to make fossil fuel more expensive. Carbon pricing, that's what that was about. Divestment to drive up the cost of capital, blocking pipelines to slow the consolidation of this industry, all in a sense to try and limit the fossil fuel industry and create a vacuum that would be eventually filled by clean energy. And now we live, as of a few years ago, in this upside down world where it's the clean energy that's cheaper, and becoming more so all the time, and where now it's the fossil fuel industry that's trying very hard to limit it because it understands that it is an existential threat to it. And so now the job in many ways of the climate movement is to take this ball that's begun to roll downhill and just get behind it and push it with everything we have to make it roll fast enough that in this metaphor, I guess it will eventually flatten Exxon at the bottom of the hill and we'll be okay. But we need to keep doing all these things at the same time. And this is, in the end, ultimately a political fight, at least if we're going to make it happen in the time that we need it to happen. So I wish I could tell everybody that they were excused from working on all of this because economics would magically do it by itself, but it won't do it in time. Instead, what I get to tell you is that we now have a clear path that we have not had in the past that allows us to sort of see where we're going. It's a path, clear path, lit by the sun. Yep. I think it's a very fine idea. Look, yes, I can. Would it be a good idea to call every politician you know and get on their butt about the solar app and balcony solar and so on and so forth? And yes, it would. Like, Colorado is obviously doing good things, and it's got a governor who's clearly committed to some of this work, and many thanks for it. And you've got excellent people and City of Boulder and in the county who have done tremendous work in really in some ways leading the country. And I'm so grateful to people who have done things like initiate these big lawsuits with the fossil fuel industry and on and on and on. But there's always more to be done. So in this case, I think an easy task, if only the people in this room called their legislators, I think the balcony solar thing is almost a gimme, you know, that there's enough people here, because there's literally no reason not to do it, that's the kind of thing that can be done quickly and easily. And then when it's done, you have this beautiful image all over the place of stuff going in, you know. People can see by the hundreds and then the thousands and then the tens of thousands the apartment balconies with solar panels hanging off the roof. And so that's a beautiful place to start, and well within the means of even just the people in this room to accomplish. But we'll be working hard on it at Third Act, yes, to see if we can get it done here as in other places. We just introduced the legislation last week in Vermont, and in Manhattan on Friday, the state assemblywoman who's in charge of the committee promised that she would, at the Sunday thing, that she would introduce it tomorrow. So time for Colorado to catch right up. Do we have time for one more? One more, all right. She lives in senior housing, and what's the clinching argument to convince people to jump in? The argument will be different for different people, okay? There's a powerful utilitarian and economic case to be made here about solar energy, and there will be people attracted to that. Some of the older men in the senior housing colony will love nothing more than the engineering task of playing around with solar panels, okay, and heat pumps and things. This is a perfect. One of the things we did on Sunday was have lots and lots and lots of homes across the nation opened for people to show their neighbors their heat pumps, and I know many gentlemen my age who. Nothing could have been more fun than talk about their heat pumps for a good hour and a half, okay? So there's some of them. But there's also, you know, plenty of people in your community who will be moved by a kind of moral or even sort of spiritual argument about this. I'm off to New York tomorrow for a couple of days, but then at the end of the week, I leave for Rome because the new Pope is hauling in a few people to talk about climate change on the 10th anniversary of Laudato Si. And by the end of the year, they broke ground on a big solar farm outside Rome a few weeks ago. By the end of the year, Vatican City will be the first fully solarized state on the planet. It is an odd thing to have reached the moment when the most progressive global institution on earth is the Roman Catholic Church, but there you are. But that's, you know, I think you can argue to people in your community that if the Vatican can accomplish this, so too can your community. Everybody's at the age where they have to start thinking about what the conversation's going to be like when they reach the pearly gates, you know? So this is very energy from heaven, not from hell. There we end. Many thanks, y'all.
You were just listening to Bill McKibben on the clean energy revolution. He spoke in Boulder, Colorado in late September. Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org, is a leading environmental activist. He's the author of many books, and his latest is Here Comes the Sun. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year, was supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as David Corton, Winona LaDuc, Amy Goodman, and Claudia de la Cruz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting for free, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with George Harrison's Here Comes the Sun, performed by the Petersons.
Here comes the sun, here comes the sun, and I say, it's all right. Here comes the sun, and I say, it's all right.